This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Governor J.B. Pritzker and Senate Minority Leader Bill Brady are both talking about bipartisan cooperation, but they have fundamental disagreements about taxation.
Prosperity doesn't trickle down, it trickles up.
It goes both ways. We believe that the market builds better economic opportunity.
Eric Stock reports Central Illinois lawmaker reaction to the state budget message. Plus, Ryan Denham talks with Brianna Joy Gray, senior politics editor at Intercept, about identity politics during her visit to ISU. J.H. Hart's M.M.? No, don't carve those initials in the trees. It's GLT's grow. And what's an Oscar broadcast without a little drama? Laura Kennedy and GLT's culture maven, Dish. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker recalled Illinois' darkest days during his first budget address, but he's also looking to get beyond the current financial mess and is calling for higher taxes now and in the future. IPR's Jacqueline Driscoll has more.
Governor J.B. Pritzker began his speech with a history lesson, invoking former Governor Henry Horner, who led Illinois through the Depression. It was a time when nearly half the workforce was unemployed, teachers hadn't been paid in a year, and farmers across the state were facing bankruptcy.
Indeed, despite all the economic troubles the state faced during the Great Depression, Horner still managed to increase school funding, institute unemployment insurance and pensions for older Illinoisans, create building programs for state institutions, and improve public health services.
Pritzker isn't facing a situation quite as bleak. Although the state has billions in unpaid bills and over $130 billion in unfunded pension liabilities. Despite calling his budget austere, the first-term governor wants to increase spending on education, social services, and public safety. And that's something that stood out to State Representative Jim Durkin, the minority leader in the House. He says he and other leaders from the House and Senate met with the governor before the budget address, and he didn't get the idea that Pritzker was focused on austerity.
And it was clear to me that there is going to be some sharp divides on how we manage this year's budget. What I did see, what first and foremost, is that there's more spending this year.
Pritzker styles himself as a fighter for the working class, citing the passage of a higher minimum wage. Speaking to his base, Pritzker defended the spending increases as an investment in the future. And remember former Governor Henry Horner? He was also seen as a champion during difficult times. But maybe more importantly, he also sought new taxes. He's known for signing the state's first permanent sales tax into law, and shortly after, increasing it. Pritzker is following that example as well. His spending plan for the next fiscal year relies on over $1 billion in new revenue, coming from taxing Medicaid providers, legalizing sports betting and recreational marijuana, and adding taxes on e-cigarettes and plastic bags, among other increases.
The budget I present to you today is an honest proposal. The costs are not hidden. The revenues I propose are not out of reach. The hole we need to fill is not ignored.
All of that, the governor says, will act as a bridge to get his big priority, a graduated income tax.
Now, it will take 18 months to get done, but it's worth the wait so that we can save working families hundreds or thousands of dollars per year.
But there's still a lot of convincing to do regarding Pritzker's proposals to generate revenue. Republicans are not on board with the progressive income tax idea, and many have spoken out against legalizing recreational marijuana. State Senator Chapin Rose, a Republican from Mahomet, says he liked what the governor had to say, but he is still looking for details about where the money will come from.
And ultimately, it comes down to this, though. Can you actually pay for the promises you're making? And early on in his speech, he said, this is a budget that lives within our existing revenues. Four pages later, he notes that he needs $1.1 billion in new revenues to make it work.
State Representative David McSweeney, a Republican from Barrington Hills, says he's skeptical, to say the least.
This budget is a joke. More of the same. Higher taxes, more spending. That's the Pritzker plan.
Despite Republican opposition, Pritzker does have Democratic supermajorities in both the Illinois House and Senate. But if the legislature fails to approve the new revenue, Pritzker says he will be forced to make cuts across state government. I'm Jacqueline Driscoll.
GLT's Eric Stock reports that Central Illinois Republicans, who are now heavily in the minority in the state legislature, struggled to find much good in Governor Pritzker's spending plan.
Republicans didn't think it was all bad. Dan Brady, the Illinois House Deputy Republican Leader from Bloomington, gives faint praise.
I would give the governor a big plus for effort, style, being here and presenting a budget on time.
An apparent reference to the 2 years Illinois went without a budget during the Bruce Rauner administration. As for the substance of the governor's address, Pritzker's $39 billion blueprint focuses on spending for health and human services, public safety, and education. Brady was pleased to hear the governor call for more money for higher education. Brady has served on a legislative committee that's been working on a new funding formula for public colleges and universities.
Music to my ears and that of many others, probably around the higher education, in particular the Illinois State, my district, is talking about a 5% increase.
Brady says that would mean an additional $3.4 million for Illinois State University. The state would also boost funding for student MAP grants and for special education. State Senator Bill Brady of Bloomington, the Senate minority leader, says there are parts of Pritzker's budget plan he thinks the GOP can get behind.
Revenues from enacting a sports betting program, increasing our federal revenue share in our Medicaid program, some of the priorities that he's emphasized in the area of higher education and education are important to us.
But the praise ends there. Republicans largely questioned how the governor was able to fix the state's budget mess, drawing from funding sources that don't even exist, at least not yet, such as a graduated income tax, which Pritzker has rebranded as the fair tax. State Senator Bill Brady says businesses benefit from the current flat tax, and moving to tax the wealthy, he says, would put Illinois at a competitive disadvantage.
They know that government officials are less likely to raise tax rates too high because everyone has to pay that. And if you go into a graduated system like some other states have, businesses will be threatened that they will have to pay a bulk, extraordinary amount of a lot higher tax.
Enacting a graduated income tax would require changing the Illinois Constitution. That would require a voter referendum. The earliest that could happen is next year. Senator Brady says he doesn't think 60% of voters will support. That's the required minimum to change the Constitution. And there's recreational marijuana. Pritzker has made it one of his major policy initiatives and seems to have enough support in the legislature. Even Republican State Senator Jason Berrickman of Bloomington has advocated for legal weed. He says it's possible the state could see revenue from legalization in the coming fiscal year, but there is much more work to be done before that.
We are getting the cart a bit ahead of the horse there in counting and booking those revenues when all of the details haven't been worked out.
Pritzker estimates licensing marijuana growers would generate $170 million a year for the state. And there's also sports gambling, which Pritzker estimates could generate $200 million a year. Representative Dan Brady says he could support the concept of legal sports betting, but even if lawmakers approve it and legal pot, there's no guarantee it will lift the budget out of the red.
All of them have the potential of not bringing in the dollars that are on these pages, and that's why this is a blueprint, and that's why he's building it on foundation of revenues of, you know, like any governor has, of unknown revenue sources of truly that money is going to be there.
Pritzker is counting on support from Democrats to pass these revenue enhancements. Senator Dave Kaler of Peoria, the assistant majority leader, says the state is missing out on low-hanging fruit to other states and underground industries by not legalizing marijuana and sports gambling.
Sports betting already goes on, so it just it's not necessarily legal and it isn't taxed. So this is just recognizing what the reality is out there and trying to create a system whereby the state of Illinois derives some benefit out of that in terms of revenue.
The governor also outlined a 5-point plan to address the state's pension debt. Along with adopting a graduated income tax, it calls for deferring pension payments, transferring assets, and borrowing money. Representative Dan Brady says he believes the state's middle class will also suffer and not just the wealthy.
What's being proposed, the way I'm reading it, is kind of like paying off your house mortgage, starting in another one then, at a higher rate than what you had before.
One funding priority that Republicans say would have drawn bipartisan cheers got only a token mention in Pritzker's budget address, a capital bill to fund road, bridge, and school construction. Illinois last passed a capital bill 10 years ago. State Senator Jason Berrickman suspects Pritzker hasn't come up with a way to fund the capital bill.
How you pay for that, you know, is always a question, and that's a significant question this year. And you got to be careful not to double count payments, right? If the governor's proposing, on the one hand, to book cannabis sales towards his operating budget, you can't take those cannabis sales and then count them again for a capital budget.
The Pritzker administration says the state faces a $3.2 billion budget hole. They say the problem is far worse than what Bruce Rauner claimed when he left office. Since Pritzker has supermajorities in both chambers, he might not need any Republican support to pass his budget. That concerns Representative Dan Brady, based on how the billionaire pushed through his first legislative initiative, the minimum wage increase.
I hope that the future of bipartisanship, that the minimum wage bill was not an example of how that's going to work. If he truly wants our help, I pledge my help and we'll work with him. But we haven't seen that yet.
Democrats and Republicans in Springfield haven't worked together well in recent years, and it remains to be seen whether their relationship will improve under another first-time legislator in Pritzker. In his budget address, he articulated how fundamentally different the two parties are when it comes to economic growth, and the GOP shared a much different view.
Prosperity doesn't trickle down, it trickles up.
It goes both ways. We believe that the market builds better economic opportunity.
Senator Bill Brady says the state should be more friendly to businesses. I'm Eric Stock.
Lawmakers have until the end of May to pass a state budget for the year that starts in July. Otherwise, Democrats would need a supermajority to pass a spending plan, in which case they might need some Republican support. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, making an impact one grant at a time. Accepting applications February 1st through 28th for programs focused on arts and culture, education, environment, wellness, youth, and more. Details at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Health officials say teenagers are using e-cigarettes at epidemic rates. Lawmakers in a number of Midwestern states like Indiana, Illinois, and Minnesota are addressing the problem. So is the FDA. Side Effects Public Media's Araceli Gomez-Aldana spoke recently with Mitch Zeller, director of the FDA Center for Tobacco Products, about his work.
Overall tobacco use, unfortunately, remains the leading cause of preventable disease and death in the United States, and this is cigarette use, smokeless tobacco use, and what we are launching now is an expansion of our smokeless tobacco youth prevention campaign aimed at the most vulnerable and at-risk teens, and that's teenage boys growing up in rural communities around the country. We have a national smokeless tobacco usage rate for teenage boys of just under 9%. In Indiana, it's almost double. It's 15.7%. Based upon the last data that we saw. It's nothing short of an epidemic when it comes to teenage boys growing up in rural communities in states like Indiana. And the tagline of the campaign is simple. Smokeless doesn't mean harmless. Too many boys are walking around thinking, well, I'm not smoking a cigarette. I see my dad dipping. I see my uncle dipping. It's a rite of passage. And they don't think about the health consequences.
Can you talk about some of the challenges you're facing when it comes to electronic cigarettes and youth?
Not only do kids not know what the nicotine content is of e-cigarettes, there's a whole bunch of teenagers walking around, at least based upon the survey data, not even knowing that nicotine is present because the harshness of the nicotine is masked by the flavors. So nationally, we have an epidemic of e-cigarette use amongst teens, and this is another one of FDA's major priorities when it comes to how can we use the dollars that we have to invest in paid advertising to get the word out to those who are at greatest risk. E-cigarettes are by far the most popular category of tobacco products with 12 to 17-year-olds nationally. When it comes to teenage boys living and growing up in rural communities, the problem is smokeless tobacco, and we're going to also have an effort focused on reducing the number of boys that become smokeless tobacco users. But we need to do all of this together. It's a concerted effort.
This issue has received more attention recently from people and lawmakers. They're paying closer attention. Have you seen any difference since the FDA has taken a stance against smokeless tobacco?
I'm very proud to say that from our efforts through the Real Cost campaign, where we launched our Real Cost cigarette prevention campaign in 2014, simply being exposed to those ads has resulted in almost 350,000 kids nationally who would have gone on to smoke who won't. And we've done an additional analysis that we published last year, which showed that of those kids that would have gone on to become regular smokers who won't, simply by being exposed to our ads, down the road that's going to save society over $31 billion because those kids won't become regular smokers, they won't become sick, they won't get the cancer, lung disease, and heart disease, and we will have saved the costs of treating those illnesses because those kids didn't become regular smokers because of exposure to our advertising. We hope to have the same impact on smokeless tobacco and e-cigarettes as well.
Mitch Zeller is the director of the FDA Center for Tobacco Products. He spoke with Eric Kaylee Gomez-Aldana of Side Effect Public Media. To curb the use of e-cigarettes, the FDA is partnering with Scholastics to educate children and teens about nicotine addiction. There's also information for all ages on the Real Cost Campaign website.
GLT is a service of Illinois State University. Illinois State now offers a McLean County Full Tuition Scholarship Competition. Every student from McLean County entering will receive a one-time $500 scholarship, while five will receive full tuition for 4 years. More at admissions.illinoisstate.edu. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The term identity politics can mean a lot of things. A description of how your race, gender, or sexuality informs your politics, or for conservatives, it's a term of derision. The fact we can't agree even on a definition of identity politics is a problem, according to Brianna Joy Gray, the senior politics editor at Intercept. She visited Illinois State University this week for a Black History Month talk. GLT's Ryan Denham spoke to Gray about the identity politics in the Trump era, starting with this week's news that Bernie Sanders was joining the crowded 2020 Democratic field.
The most remarkable thing is the difference in numbers from what we had last time around. And that has led some people to opine that it's not smart for Bernie to get in the race. You know, what value add can there possibly be? I think that's actually not the case. To the extent that the field is very crowded, it's crowded with kind of the same centrist, dare I say, neoliberal candidate that we've gotten in the past. And that in terms of people who are in direct kind of ideological competition with Bernie Sanders, it's really pretty limited to Elizabeth Warren, maybe Tulsi, you know. So I actually think that he does offer something insofar as he's setting the actual standard for the leftmost candidate in the race, presumably, given, you know, how he ran last time. And that it will, to the extent that everyone else has kind of adopted his 2016 platform over the course of the last 2 years, he's drawing a real affirmative line in the sand and actually participating in the race. And they will have to actually substantiate more fully, I think, the extent to which they've committed to his policies now that he's there to actually defend them himself.
And you wrote a piece last summer about what Democrats should take away from Stacey Abrams' gubernatorial primary win in Georgia. Abrams later lost the general election, mm-hmm. but her nomination, you know, as a black woman in a southern state, was certainly notable. So what are the lessons that these 2020 presidential candidates on the Democratic side, white or of color, what should they take away from the Abrams experience in Georgia?
Yeah, the case that I was making about Abrams is that a lot of people characterized her as an identity politics candidate and basically kind of reduced her appeal to the fact of her being black. When the reality was, when you actually looked at her messaging and watched the debates and looked at all of her ads and the ads of her competitor, Stacey Evans, what you saw is that, if anything, Stacey Evans was the one who was running on these kind of identity markers, really emphasizing this Hope scholarship program that had particular impacts on the black community. She had a controversial TV ad that had Martin Luther King's face kind of fade into hers. She talked a lot about how she was really from Georgia, whereas Stacey Abrams was from Mississippi. You know, all of these kind of like who I am arguments. Whereas Stacey Abrams made the case for how she was going to kind of materially uplift the people of Georgia. And she didn't limit it to race, even though a lot of newscasters and journalists kept trying to pressure her in that direction. So she would be asked, she would, you know, be asked questions like, don't you think you aren't trying to reach out, you're not trying to court white voters like other people would do, right? You're not trying to court the white working class. And Stacey Abrams would say, you know, that's a mischaracterization of what's going on here. The working class in Georgia is very diverse. There are a lot of black farmers in Georgia and a lot of black people in rural communities. And I want to reach out to all voters because I think that my message has something to give to all voters. There's benefit there. And I think that, ironically, a lot of candidates of color have a lot more leeway to cast that broader net without needing to kind of constantly reaffirm their commitments to communities of color. So I do think that candidates of color should understand that that's a huge advantage that they have and take advantage of kind of the broad populist messaging that is, in fact, so popular. At the same time, candidates who aren't of color, white candidates like Bernie Sanders, I think, are going to have to do a little bit more work to connect their message to particular communities of color who are used to being underserved by programs that are somehow sometimes pitched as universal.
Well, can you define the term identity politics in your own view? I think it's a term that's used descriptively as a criticism by some conservatives. What is your like working definition?
Yeah, that's a really good question because I think a lot of the controversy around identity politics is just because people are operating with different definitions. So I think essentially identity politics it's a recognition that that people who come from marginalized backgrounds who have, you know, non-white, non-male, non-straight identities, in order to achieve equality, are going to have to have specific concerns that are related to their identity. So if you've been marginalized on the basis of your identity historically, it makes sense then to draw attention to that identity and as, you know, a way to show exactly what deficits need to be compensated for, and to use that identity as a way to build kind of a coalition among people who share similar needs and leverage political power, right? At the same time, the complaint about identity, I think, is most often about people who would weaponize identity politics to advance a form of politics that isn't necessarily actually beneficial to the identity group that's being evoked. So what you had in 2016 were people who were basically defending, let's say, Hillary Clinton on the basis that she was a woman, even though, for example, she picked a VP who personally didn't even support the right to choose, right? Or you had people who were critical of Kamala Harris even before she announced in 2020, years ago, back when I wrote that identity politics article, on the basis of her prosecutorial record and her failure to prosecute Steve Mnuchin and myriad other acts as DA in California, and she was defended on the basis that she was black, despite the fact that her policies disproportionately had a negative effect on black people. So there's another critique of identity from the right, which is basically to say identity doesn't matter. Why is anybody ever talking about race or gender or sexuality? And I think that that critique is meritless. But that gets conflated, I think, unfairly with this critique of weaponized identity. So people who actually do want to advocate for people from marginalized groups, but see people kind of cravenly using identity to advance politics that don't benefit the underlying group, but instead to shore up, I think, kind of corporate neoliberal politics.
I want to talk about Elizabeth Warren for a second. Mm-hmm. So Elizabeth Warren, her missteps on her Native American ancestry, including the decision to release this DNA test. Mm-hmm. As someone who knows a lot about, you know, the intersection of politics and identity, do you think this is something that she can overcome? Do you think that she still has a chance to win in this type of field?
I don't think that there is a such thing as a political problem that can't be negotiated around. I think that there is no bad act that is beyond kind of apology and, more importantly, penance and a demonstration that you've learned from your mistakes and you can move past them. I don't want to live in a world where someone would be kind of canceled forever because of any mistake, much less one like this. But my concern is that it is a pretty significant unforced error. The Native American controversy has been percolating for well over a year now, years really, actually. Censor Senate campaign. And the fact that she chose at this point in the game last fall to release a film, that clip, whatever, the YouTube clip that was so dramatically ill-advised, that raised a whole bunch of other issues about her approach to affirmative action. Affirmative action ended up getting kind of thrown under the bus because one of her defenses was, I, in fact, was qualified, as though being a Native American admit would imply that she was not. It gives me pause about her ability to manage other difficult controversies that are going to come down the pike. And there's no reason to suspect that someone like Donald Trump is going to stop hitting her on these kinds of issues. And so it's not that I don't think that she can hypothetically get past it, but I haven't seen a demonstration from her at this point that she has the kind of constitution or the kind of team that is going to be able to effectively thread that needle.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm joined by Brianna Joy Gray, the senior politics editor at The Intercept. She's visiting Illinois State University today for a speech as part of the campus's Black History Month celebration. So, Brianna, I want to pivot to the Republicans, if we can. We've been focusing a lot on the Democrats. Republicans are struggling with women, and particularly office holders. There are just 20 Republican women now in Congress as of this session. The numbers of female office holders in the GOP have fallen in state houses, too, across the country. And so their bench is getting a little thin because that is the bench for Congress. Why do you think that is?
For a group that doesn't believe that representation matters, I think it makes sense that you wouldn't see a very deep representational bench there. It doesn't seem that Republican women mind that much. I mean, you saw famously... 53% of white women vote for Donald Trump. For whatever reason, politically, culturally, it doesn't seem to be the same kind of rallying point that it is on the left. And as long as it doesn't matter to the base, there's no reason to try to deepen the bench. I don't know if it's actually an issue of there not being a deep enough pool, that there are not enough women who are Republican who actually want to go into office, because there's certainly enough Republican female voters who espouse those views. So I'm not sure what institutional factors are keeping there from being more women at play, but I suspect it has a lot to do with politics that they're, underlying politics that frankly aren't really accommodating to the interest of representational diversity.
When I ask about another woman who's been in the political news quite a bit recently, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You actually interviewed her recently for an Intercept podcast called Deconstructed. After spending some time with her, what is your sense of kind of the role that she plays potentially in the future of the Democratic Party?
To the extent that there is a balkanization between people who want to focus primarily on identity and people who want to focus on substantive politics, she represents the fact that there doesn't have to be a trade-off. You can have the representational value of someone who has life experiences that may inform their policy perspective, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez does, and who also embraces substantive, progressive, democratic socialist policies. And there is this kind of fallacy around Bernie Sanders from a minority of Democrats who hate him very much, universalist material economic policies are counter to the interests of people of color, when that is in fact the opposite of what's true. And I think the existence of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez manifests that in the form of an actual human being. I also don't want to downplay the extent to which, just as an individual, she has an enormous amount of charisma and rhetorical acuity, and is just able to talk about issues in a way that foregrounds human dignity and basic humanist values that I think resonates really far and gets a lot of people who don't even consider themselves liberals to not be dismissive of her message. And I can't wait to see what she does with it.
That's Brianna Joy Gray, the senior politics editor at The Intercept, speaking with GLT's Ryan Denham. She spoke this week at Illinois State University as part of its Black History Month celebration.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, GLT correspondent Laura Kennedy and culture maven Sherry Zeck dish on the Oscars. We've all seen initials, maybe surrounded by a heart carved into a tree. The tree survives, but we also all know carving your initials into a tree is wrong. In this edition of our gardening podcast, Grow, Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University's School of Biological Sciences tells GLT's Mike McCurdy there are some common sense things to follow to respect trees and nature.
We've all seen initials, maybe surrounded by a heart, carved into a tree. The tree survives, usually, but we also know carving your initials into a tree is wrong. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. Murph, how are you?
Good to be with you, Mike. I'm fine. Thank you.
So we're talking about respecting trees and nature. Can you elaborate a little bit?
Well, I go back to my childhood, I guess, on this one, and I recall Smokey the Bear, who said, "Only you can prevent forest fires." I thought that was an interesting, timeless message. And then around the same time period, we had Woodsy the Owl. He said, "Give a hoot, don't pollute." I'm not sure if Woodsy was a he or a she, but Woodsy said,
sure,
"Don't pollute." And this is a vintage message, but the issue is ongoing. So I guess I would ask everyone and you the question, do we need a modern-day Woodsy the Owl? I think it would probably be nice.
I think maybe we're playing that role today.
Oh, what an honor that is.
So how much of what we're going to talk about is just common sense, like don't carve your initials into a tree?
Many tree and nature respect practices and behaviors are common sense, but they deserve reviewing. You should really take nothing but pictures, leave nothing but footprints, and kill nothing but time. Ironically, that's a quote from an old Washington, D.C. brothel.
Oh, really?
Kind of sad.
I had no idea that was from a brothel.
Well, I was doing some brothel history research and came across that. So, yeah.
So I have a piece of petrified wood from, wait for it, Petrified Forest National Park. I didn't take it. A family member lifted it decades ago. This is actually illegal, right?
I think it is.
So what about other plants, rocks, animals from anywhere, not just national parks? What's the best practice?
Well, before I answer, I want you to know I have some of that same petrified wood that came home with folks that went to Yellowstone, Joshua Tree, and brought back this wonderful stuff. But it is illegal to take plants and animals, wood, and soil from national and most state park systems. There are permits required for stands and perches that one would set out to observe nature or for the purposes of hunting, studying, or photographing wildlife.
A lot of times, even for established mountain bike trails at state parks, you still need a permit to ride your bike, too.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So what about leaving things behind? It's illegal probably to take things, right, in most instances, or just not a great practice. You should just leave it as you found it. What about leaving things after you've been there?
It's also illegal to abandon animals there. My wife and I had an experience at Fox Lake Park in Charleston, Illinois, and we found a dog that someone had sadly abandoned there. It's illegal to abandon plants or plant waste, particularly wood, and litter. That makes common sense, right?
So what's the main reason? I mean, obviously, it's going to clutter up or you know, you don't want to dump your garbage at a state park. But, you know, wood, is that because of the invasive species or insects that might be in the wood?
Exactly.
Can we sometimes leave behind what we don't even see or maybe aren't even aware of? Let's say garlic mustard seeds or seeds from other invasive plants on our shoes. There are sometimes these shoe brushes I see at trailheads, so you can rake your shoe through them to kind of knock off some of the invasive species. I assume that's sort of a problem people don't even think about.
I think so, because it's a problem we encounter at the Science Laboratory Building Research Greenhouse. We're fighting some pests right now, and we believe that they probably came in on people's clothes from another area or chamber where plants that were infected were held. And that's a great point, Mike, about the shoe and tire brushes that you have at parks. And absolutely, diseases like canker, various kinds of weed seeds, they can be carried around in the folds of your clothes or in the mud on your shoes.
And are those shoe brushes, I guess they're better than nothing. Are they effective?
I would think they would have to be. And what's nice about them is you're not wasting a bunch of water and not inoculating those seeds with something to help them grow. You're just knocking them off your shoes or your bicycle tires.
I've seen trees used as signposts, fence posts. Is this just a case of not using one's head or not caring?
Well, I can tell you that using trees to display signs also requires some level of permission or permitting. Typically, the rules include no permanent fasteners like nails or screws are allowed. Rather, they encourage the use of cordage, tape, bungees to temporarily hang a sign, for example.
So let me admit something. I have actually locked my bike to a tree. After we talked about this, I realized that at a movie theater here in town, I rode my bike to a movie, and there was no bike rack. And there were some trees out in front in sort of spaces in the sidewalk that would allow the tree to just enough space to grow. So I locked my bike to that. Didn't want to, didn't really have a choice. There was nothing else to lock to. I've also wrapped a cable around a tree at a campsite and locked a bike. Again, not great practices, but I didn't damage the tree, did I?
That's the key thing, I think, Mike, is so, you know, there's a building right here on campus, Fell Hall, that has a little patio area near the front where there's a garbage can and some bike racks and a little bit of frontage seating. And near that bike rack, there is a tree. Now, there's plenty of times when students roll up on their bikes and there's no vacancy in the rack, so they go to the tree. And that is related to site selection, right? So you can't blame everything on somebody like locking a bike to a tree. But then there's the behavior part of it. There's the respect part of it. Did you lock it around there with a logging chain and draw it tight like you're trying to pull a grizzly bear out of a tree? Probably not. You were probably kind, and you just had it locked on there tight enough to prevent somebody from, you know, stealing the tires off of it or whatever. I think that that points out the difference between respecting something or, you know, you got to have the right to secure your belongings. I don't think that that's evil. I just think you have to practice taking care of the tree.
I didn't secure it tight. My main concern was that I was afraid somebody might actually damage the tree further, chop the top off of it, and just lift my bike out and go.
That's a real possibility.
Because the tree wasn't very big, and you can cut through a tree pretty easily if you really wanted the bike. I've camped with people who prefer a hammock over a tent. Tell me about hammocking and properly tying it off to a tree. I've actually seen people do this on the Illinois State University quad as well.
It's popular here on the quad in the Fell Arboretum. There is also a student club at Illinois State called Hammond Out ISU, and they meet regularly, and they utilize hammocks for student life and study time activities. And these practices need to include respect measures that prevent damaging trees while hanging and using the hammocks. It's kind of common sense, again, accompanied by some respect behavior. No chain or wire tie downs. Cushions are best, but rare. A cushion can be a couple of folds of cardboard. Hmm. It doesn't have to be something that you go and invest a lot of money in.
Just something to protect the bark.
Flat straps and compressible cordage are common on these kinds of hammocks and tents and things nowadays, and they can be used without damaging the bark and the crucial cambium layer that's right beneath the bark.
So are you going to ruin climbing trees for kids?
Absolutely not. Children need to know how to climb trees and how to fall out of them without getting hurt.
So it's okay. It's okay to climb a tree. You just have to be careful about how you do it.
Yeah, and
mainly kids, not adults.
Right, and you know, if a tree is climbable for a child, it's climbable for an adult.
And maybe the branches may not be big enough to support an adult.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. Climbing trees can be fun and allow for a great vantage point to gaze on nature. But there are trees that are prone to a type of disease called canker. There are many canker disease scenarios, but the soil particles on the bottom of our shoes can be put into contact with the tree while we force ourselves up into the tree.
If you have any questions about respecting trees and nature, submit them at wglt.org/grow. Next week, we'll talk about whether starting plants from seeds or live plants is better. Why not a combination of both?
For education purposes, a combination of both is very wise.
Okay, we'll talk more about that next week on Grow. I'm Mike McCurdy with Patrick Murphy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
Subscribe to this and our other podcasts at wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. What's an Oscar telecast without a little drama, or even a lot of drama, courtesy of controversy and the ever-obliging social media? GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
The drama's not just up on the big screen where Oscar is concerned. The big controversy this year involved Kevin Hart as host of the show. When some ill-advised tweets resurfaced, Hart bailed on the Academy, leaving them hostless for the first time in history. Then came more controversy involving nominated songs and award presenters. Surely the Academy was aghast. "Don't you believe it," says Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University and GLT's culture maven. Zeck says these pre-show controversies add an interesting luster to that little man of gold.
Well, you know, people are losing interest, so they have to gin up some free advertisement somehow.
You mean they deliberately did that with Kevin Hart?
I don't know if they deliberately did that with Kevin Hart, but I'm sure they deliberately did it with the song.
So they actually, with regards to the best nominated songs, instead of having all five of them performed, they're only allowing two of them be performed.
Well, that's what they said last week. And then there was public outcry, lots of press, headlines, and now they decided, oh yes, we'll have all five be performed.
That's exactly what they did with regards to the actors who won the previous year. And they were not supposed to be presenting
exactly.
To the new winners this year. And there was much hue and cry. I think Allison Janney
was one.
Tweeted about it.
Right. The thinking was that the Oscar producers decided last year's winners just weren't big enough names, right?
Ouch.
Weren't sort of going to be a good television draw.
I would bop them over the head with my Oscar just to say that.
Absolutely. So they have relented on that as well. But again, lots of free press. And the way they relented, I believe, is that last year's winners are going to present, but they're going to be presenting together. They get everybody who won in there with half the screen time, basically. But back to the Kevin Hart thing. It's not new for there to be some to-do about Oscars. But remember, it wasn't that long ago that Bob Hope hosted them every year. So then Billy Crystal did it year after year after year. And people would look forward to Billy Crystal as much as the show itself, and who was going to win, who was going to lose. We just kind of don't have anybody right now that's that kind of draw to the show, that has that kind of identity with the show.
Rumor has it that Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, was offered the job before they offered it to Kevin Hart, but he couldn't. He said he couldn't work it out with his schedule. The guy is box office Teflon right now. Do you think Dwayne would make a good host someday?
I don't know how funny he is. I mean, part of The really good hosts, the Billy Crystals, they're good not just because they can read the lines that are presented to them, but because when there are those glitches, when things come up that aren't quite right, they can ad lib and they can make an uncomfortable moment funny, or they can cover when there's a 10-second break or something like that. I don't know if The Rock has those particular skills or not. He's certainly a big personality and a compelling person to see on stage. I mean, he can command the stage, but I don't know if he has those kinds of chops. Who's the guy who wrote Family Guy? He hosted one year.
He was a little over the top.
He was awful.
Yeah.
He was awful. And I remember there were several jokes that he made that rubbed people the wrong way. I mean, he's, I think, a really good example of where Oscar can get itself into trouble by trying to go to someone who appeals to a younger, hipper audience as opposed to the Billy Crystals, the Bob Hopes, you know, the appeal to a people with more longevity invested in the Oscars. They're going to get people who shoot from the hip, who say things off the cuff, whose humor is not placid and bland. And of course, things are complicated by social media. Every random thought someone has had is out there to be discovered. So I think trying to find people who will connect with a younger audience who have never said or done anything to offend anyone is going to be very difficult.
There's also a bit of controversy regarding Bryan Singer, who directed Bohemian Rhapsody, and he was fired after he had done a lot of the directing because he went away and then he didn't come back, and now there are these sexual misconduct allegations against him. And I'm wondering how much that kind of revelation is going to impact the chances of Bohemian Rhapsody winning the Oscar and also Rami Malek winning Best Actor. Will that scandal, will it have collateral damage?
No, if anything, I think it will help Malik, because he's been doing a little bit of press about, yeah, it was difficult, but, you know, I survived. And I don't think that will happen. I think Bohemian Rhapsody has enough problems on its own as a film to weight it down in the Best Picture category. But I might be getting ahead of myself here, but Malik's my pick for Best Actor.
Okay, well, let's talk about why you don't think, say, Bradley Cooper is going to get it for A Star is Born.
I don't think that's really an Oscar-worthy performance. People may be talking about some compensation votes because he wasn't nominated as director, but there are too many other really good standout performances this year that I don't think he's going to make it.
What do you think about Christian Bale's turn in the film Vice?
I think that Bale probably has the best performance of the year. I think he's an extraordinary actor. He basically could win any time out. But he's gotten a lot of recognition for many things. I don't think this film was particularly well-liked. I think Malik is going to take it, because there's just this feeling about the Oscars. It's the move toward the young, toward the new. He did a fantastic job impersonating or playing a particularly difficult person to impersonate. It required a lot of different skills, not just voice and mannerism. So I think that's going to play very well for him. I think his youth will play very well for him. It's one of those years where it sort of feels like his year, his moment.
Let's move over to Best Actress. Mm-hmm. Do you think this might be Glenn Close's year to win for The Wife? She's been up many times, never won.
Absolutely. She's the winner.
You're emphatic about that.
Yeah, it's True Grit. I mean, it's one of those it's one of those things where she is a much admired actress. She's at an age where people are thinking, okay, how many other good roles is she going to have before she's got the old granny supporting actress role, mm-hmm. and she's never won. And even though The Wife is not a film that was widely viewed, remember, the voters, they're all getting screeners. So they don't have to have gone to the theater to see these movies. And The Wife, I think, is one of those films that's going to play perfectly fine on their 55-inch TVs. And they're going to be reminded, yeah, we really like Glenn Close. We want her to win.
I must say I was quite tickled that Melissa McCarthy was nominated for Can You Ever Forgive Me?
I love Miss Melissa McCarthy, but she's not a Best Actress, not in this role and not in a lot of roles. She's a little bit of a one-trick pony. I like her very much, but I don't think this is going to be her year. She's going to win when she has a truly dramatic role. This is a dramatic role, but when she has a truly dramatic role that's not quirky or has a funny edge where she can go to her Melissa McCarthy shtick in it. When she's really got to play a very serious role, she'll win then. She'll win because of all her great comedy work, but she'll win from one of those. But she'll get
it's so complicated.
She'll get the statue for one of those roles. Olivia Colman, terrific actress. She's just not a big Hollywood commodity.
Let's move to...
By the way, can I just say Lady Gaga? No way. I'm honestly shocked she's even nominated. Not that she didn't do a fine job in the film,
was that the Academy saying, let's get some young people tuning in because they want to see Gaga?
Maybe. Or maybe it was the Academy saying, look, A Star is Born. Every time we make an A Star is Born, it's a big movie. It's just the title of the film and the basic stuff of the film is Hollywood legend. So even if a very, very bad A Star is Born were made, we would likely see one or both of the lead characters, lead actors nominated.
So let's talk about Best Picture. And a lot of people were absolutely delighted to see that Black Panther mm-hmm. got nominated. What do you think its chances are?
Well, I think Roma is the best picture of the year, but you're going to freak right out. I think Black Panther is going to take the statue.
So why?
We've talked before about big blockbuster movies, the Marvel movies, the Star Warses and stuff, how they're keeping Hollywood afloat and they are loved, but they are not Best Picture winners.
They're not acting rewarded.
They're not rewarded with acting awards, that sort of thing. But Black Panther is clearly a superhero genre film, but it's transformative. It is a transformative genre film. It is a serious comment on our world. A lot of these genre films are, but that fantastic all-black cast, it was uplifting and inspiring and set for a sequel, and good versus evil, and all of those things we can see in a dozen other superhero films, except for the all-black cast and the notion that, okay, now we could have another all-black cast in a superhero movie. We could have a franchise. So I think there is kind of energy about Black Panther right now that says we have to take this film seriously. Voters can kind of have their cake and eat it too. They can vote for something that is meaningful sociologically, but also is fun and light, and it feels new because that cast knocked it out of the park.
That's Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University and GLT's culture maven. The 91st Academy Awards ceremony is coming up Sunday at 7 p.m. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Was Bradley Cooper robbed when he failed to get a Best Director for A Star Is Born? You can hear what Sherry Zeck thinks about that at our website, wglt.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories we help today from Ryan Denham, Eric Stock, and Laura Kennedy. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.